Thank you for listening to this download of Start the Week, presented by Tom Sutcliffe.
Hello. How much government is just enough? We're in urgent need of smaller portions, according to the authors of The Fourth Revolution, a book which argues that the West is being left behind in the race to invent a better way of making society work. One of them, Adrian Wooldridge, is with us to talk about why they think that democracy is digging itself into a hole and how it might best dig itself out again. Here to remind us that too little government can be a great deal worse than too much is Anjan Sundaram, whose memoir Stringer describes his experiences as a journalist in one of the most broken states on earth, the Congo. He's joined by Charulata Hogg, an associate fellow from Chatham House and an expert on the price paid by the poor and disenfranchised when governments fail, and the historian Tristram Hunt, taking an hour out from shadowing Michael Gove to talk about the cities shaped by the British Empire and how those cities shaped us. We start, though, with a call for revolution from Adrian Wooldridge and John Micklethwaite, journalists for The Economist magazine, co-authors of The Fourth Revolution, The Global Race to Reinvent the State. Adrian, your starting point is that government is broken and that the main political challenge of the next decade is going to be to fix it.
Absolutely.
Why is it broken? In what ways is it broken?
Well, I spent the last 10 years up to 2010 living and working in Washington, D.C., and what I saw in that period was that government got worse and worse and worse, less capable of making good decisions, less capable of responding to long-term needs of the United States, dysfunctional, in a word. And after I'd finished there, I went on a trip to China to look at the issue of state capitalism. And I was amazed by how competent the Chinese were. Not brilliant at everything, but just trying to make government better. It struck me that the Chinese had spent the 1990s learning how to do capitalism better, looking at the way European and American companies worked, learning from them, copying them. And they're doing the same government, looking all around the world to see what the best way of doing things. So it struck me that the difference in quality between Western government and the challenging government that's coming from the East is diminishing. They're getting better, we're getting worse.
Your book is called The Fourth Revolution. That's because you think there have already been three and a half, in fact. The first was the creation of the nation state. Then you get democratic reform, the extension of the franchise. That's the second revolution. The third is the creation of the modern welfare state. And the half is monetarism and Thatcherism. Uh-huh. Now, does that mean that essentially you're arguing that the work of Thatcherism is incomplete, that we've got to carry that on and finish it?
Absolutely. I think that the West has been ahead with this state-making process all the way through to the moment. It tried to reform this rather bloated state that we've created in the 1980s. Reagan and Thatcher did some remarkable things, essentially getting the state out of the business of running companies, particularly in Britain. But after that period, the state resumed its growth, particularly under the later years of New Labour on the one hand and under George Bush on the other hand. Secondly, what the state has not done enough of is to harness the powers of modern technology, modern management techniques to deliver its services better than it had. So it was a half revolution. It's important what happened in the 1980s. I also believe that what happened in the 1980s was a sort of conservative revolution in the sense that it was based on a very conservative view of what the state is about. And I think we need to complete that with a much more liberal view of what the state should and shouldn't be doing.
Is politics part of the problem here, that every innovative idea is first of all interrogated for its ideological purity? So, I mean, a lot of people will listen to you saying we need more Thatcherism and a shutter will clang down in their Absolutely. Minds and they say, no, we're not going to have that. And there might be good reasons for them thinking that.
I mean, politics is a problem partly because of veto groups. The veto groups are incredibly powerful when it comes to stopping sensible reforms that benefit the broad mass of people. But secondly, that we do have an ideological way of looking at things, particularly, I think, in the United States and Britain. And you see a lot of very sensible reforms coming, I would point to the Scandinavian countries, which have removed some of these ideological constraints. I think one of the biggest problems with the state is the power of the national security state to interrogate our lives. There's been a bloating of that state in terms of the number of employees, in terms of the power that it has to intrude into privacy. I don't think that that's a particularly right-wing notion for me.
Some would say that you're pointing to Singapore and China as examples or exemplars is a bit contradictory, given the point you've just made about an intrusive state and a state which polices its citizens more closely.
The subtitle of this book is The Global Race to Reinvent the State. And I think that what we had for the last three or four centuries was a dominance of a particular European and American system, which is essentially now a liberal democratic system. Now it has real competitors in the form of Singapore, China, authoritarian top-down modernization. And I point to those as a challenge, not an example that we should be imitating. We need to improve our performance so that the 21st century belongs to liberal democracy. And in order for it to belong to liberal democracy, rather than these new very powerful systems that are emerging in the Far East, we need to be more focused, more slim, and more modest in what we think the state ought to be doing.
Isn't there an inherent cost, though, to freedom, that it just is a little bit less efficient than an authoritarian state? If you're running a small state like Singapore and you can dictate exactly the terms on which the state runs, you can do things more efficiently, but you might not want to live like that.
Well, Tocqueville said that the interesting thing about democracy is it looks incredibly inefficient on the surface, but deep down it's more efficient because it's responsive. And autocracy is the opposite. It looks efficient, but deep down it's inefficient. I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, I think that democracy in the long term will win, but I think democracy can be badly run as well as well run. It can have too much power to veto groups. It can be too short-term in its decision-making. And I think the costs of democracy have gone up recently.
Let's just get a little bit specific about some of these ideas. You have an example from India about the provision of healthcare. Just give us that detail, because it's an interesting case of how you can supply services in a different way.
Bangalore is the sort of centre of the new India, India of IT and modern technology. And I went to visit a doctor there called Devi Shetty, who runs a huge heart hospital. And what he has managed to do in this hospital is very significantly to reduce the cost of heart operations whilst bringing them to more people. And he's done this essentially by applying Henry Ford's technique of economies of scope, of scale, division of labour. So he has the surgeons, who are obviously extremely expensive, extremely highly skilled, focusing on only the bit that has to be done by surgeons. And he has a lot of other ancillary workers doing the rest of it. So the whole preparation of the patient is done in this sort of conveyor belt system. The surgeon does it. And what they've discovered is that if you do more operations, if you have a faster throughput, you can actually also improve quality. So these hospitals are bringing, you know, top-level healthcare to a very broad group of people. He also has various other models whereby he uses the payments that are made by richer people to subsidise poorer people. So he's really reinventing healthcare.
It's a fascinating idea, but you can imagine what would happen if you tried to introduce it in America, say, that you would immediately run into huge lobby groups, both on the professional side, on the health supply side.
Well, strangely enough, he is opening a hospital in the Cayman Islands, which is, what, 3 or 4 hours away from Florida. So, and that is for American patients who will go there, get this their heart operations at a tenth of the cost that it would be on the mainland United States. And I think that's an extraordinarily powerful sort of business proposition. Also, he is already getting a lot of people going to actually travelling to India on health tourism grounds.
Cherry Latta-Hogg, I want to bring you in here. How do you react to the idea that China and, say, Singapore might be, if not exemplars, at least offer ideas?
Obviously, they're good ideas and good practices the world over, including in China and Singapore. But I think I would like to broaden this discussion and look at the role of the state in terms of, is it good governance we're looking for? Is it sustainable growth? Is it GDP figures? Are we looking at a state that creates an inclusive and just society?
Let's let Adrian answer that, because you have a line in your book, "The days when the West had a monopoly on clever government are long gone." What do you mean by clever government, to answer that question?
Well, clever government means, in one sense, a government that embodies the sort of values which we believe in, which are liberty and democracy. And I think those ideas are spreading throughout the rest of the world, not least to India. But also, in terms of just policy prescriptions, innovations, I would point to, say, Bolsa Família in Brazil, which is a system which of conditional cash transfers, whereby people, very poor people, get given a certain amount of money if they hit certain targets, such as getting vaccination for their children or sending their children to schools. This is in the context of a very poor society where many people wouldn't go to schools or get vaccinated. And I think that linking of personal behaviour to benefits is a very clever idea and has worked very well.
That is an interesting case, but it also works in the other direction, doesn't it? Because you cite California as a specific example. I mean, you say the state, good, clever government delivers liberalism and democracy. In California, democracy is, according to your argument, part of the problem because electors are constantly voting extra benefits.
Well, I think that in a sense there are good democracies and bad democracies, and in California they've taken the worst bits of democracy, which is the initiative process, which essentially allows voters to vote for whatever they want, to its absurd extremes. For example, basically you've seen a series of initiatives passed in California whereby people have voted for more spending and less taxation. So democracy can work, but it can also give in to our lowest instincts. And I think direct democracy of the initiative sort is the worst possible form.
Tristram Hunt, do you recognise this problem of ideology and, as it were, old politics being a block on innovation, that very often ideas are stopped because they don't appear to fit a pattern of loyalties, political loyalties?
Yes, but I think Adrian is absolutely right to also put this work within the context of the economists' ideas. And if you look back at the history of the economists, there's been a long opposition to any degree of state intervention. I, having looked at the history of the city in the 19th century, the vehemence of the economists' opposition to the Public Health Act of 1848, which was a ruined society, all those things, these are basic safeguards. I think what's very linear about the analysis is the difference between central and local government. And actually, we've seen, particularly in terms of British society, a massive withdrawal of the state from local government over the last 50, 100 years, and a centralisation of that power at central government. So it's not simply, as it were, just a uniform expansion. Where the state exists and in what form it exists has also changed.
You want to come back?
No, I absolutely agree with this. One of the things... We do not argue in this book that a small state is always better than a large state. Quite often, state intervention for the provision of healthcare, for the provision of education, is a very good thing. But you can do state intervention well or badly. And I certainly think what happened, particularly after 1945 in this country, which was the centralisation of government control, the gentleman in Whitehall, as Douglas Jay said, always knows best, the exclusion of voluntary organisations from the provision of state welfare. Basically, the reconstruction of the state on the model of early 20th century industrial capitalism was a bad idea.
Anjan Sundaraj, I just want to bring you in because, I mean, you write about experiences in a country where it's an absolute luxury to think about whether you have a large state or a small state, because essentially there is no state at all, except in ghost forms. And the result is appalling.
Yes, I have two sets of competing experiences to contribute to this discussion. I have my experience in Congo, where people had no state and basic services. There was no gun control. There was no provision of electricity. So each house had to pay for their own, to wire their house to the electricity grid. And people were stymied because they were incredibly entrepreneurial people. But their efforts never added up because there was no government support to provide basic infrastructure, basic services. And so you ended up with this plethora of NGOs that tried to provide services that the government should have been providing. And then I, for the last 5 years, I've lived in Rwanda, quite the opposite, almost totalitarian. And we've been talking about health. The Rwandan health system has been applauded. But I found that there were two sort of data points in my investigations that questioned whether Rwanda is really successful. Dictatorships in the past, they would dress differently, talk differently, straight jackets. You would see spies following you in the streets. Now they dress in suits. They say we're open for business. It's incredibly seductive. And the health system, I found that people were unable, they feared their doctors, for example, but they were unable to say so. And you really have to question whether statistics can capture the success of a health system when people are fearing
them. Why do they fear them?
Because there's no press. They know that if the doctor were to do or act on behalf on orders of the government or deliberately or make an error, there would be no form of redressal. There's no state. There's no way to speak up. People disappear. You can't talk about it. And already that is a failure of the health system, but this is not captured in statistics or any quantitative measures.
Tristram Hunt, this is very much what you're writing about in your book, 10 Cities That Made an Empire. You're talking about, as it were, the way in which the empire built its sort of centres of operation. And very often the first things it's beginning to do is to establish basic rules, basic legislation, and basic kind of services.
Yes, you can see how the empire and the motives of empire then are explained through the urban form, how the cities of the British Empire at each stage of the growth of the empire begin to reflect back some of the ideologies and ambitions of the empire at a particular point. And my hope in this book was then to explore some of that through civil society and through the social structures, but also through the urban form, also through the architecture, having the architect, the rituals, the civil society of each city from Hong Kong to Bombay to Melbourne to Dublin, explain the rise and fall of the British Empire and ending in Liverpool, which was this city which was so dependent upon empire and such a great colonial city in so many ways, and then also really hit by the end of empire.
I thought Calcutta was particularly pertinent to our discussion here today because you have Calcutta established essentially as a company town. It's a free enterprise empire at that point. The East India Company goes in, it sets itself up as a trading concern, and then the administration follows that, and the government, the British government, essentially says, well, get on with it. The result is so disastrous.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating about Calcutta on so many levels is that, yes, this is a trading station, and it's a competition between European powers, between the Dutch and the French and the British, to control the Bengal trade, to control the extraordinary riches coming out of that part of India. And then you have this sense under Wellesley in the late 1700s, early 1800s, that, well, we should be more than a counting house empire. Actually, the calling and function of the British Empire is greater than this. And so it wants the territorial ambition of empire with that sort of Roman conception in mind. So it's the move, in a sense, from that rather narrow trading post conception of empire to a grander calling about what to be British in the world was about.
Adrian Woolridge, this is partly what government is for, isn't it? To hold trading concerns in restraint. I mean, the Bengal famine occurs because the East India Company spots the fact that the rice harvest isn't going to be good. And its first thought is, well, we can corner the market in rice. No, and millions of people die.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that the government plays an absolutely vital role in the functioning of capitalism. But the point is, it can become too bloated, it can overplay its hand. And I think Calcutta is a very interesting example of that, in the sense that Calcutta becomes, after 1948, frozen in the idea that government is good, that the private sector is bad, that the place should be run by either the Communist Party of India Marxist or the Communist Party of India Marxist-Leninist. And that has really held back Calcutta as compared with Bombay or New Delhi or particularly southern parts of the country for a significant period of time. Too much government is worse than too little.
Cherry Latta-Hogg, do you recognise that description of a city you've lived in?
Yes, but I would like to take Adrian's point on whether too much government is a bad thing. The question is, we want a more accountable government rather than less government. We want a more just government. And I think in all these areas, and if you look at India as a whole, not just Calcutta, if you see the level of health care. And I take your point about Dev Shetty. He's one of a billion. You know, you have in India a situation where 597 million people defecate in the open. I think this has been a big controversy, and it's important to bring this issue right now as the UK is hosting the summit on sexual violence in conflict. You know, the issue of sexual violence in India needs state intervention. It needs accountability. It needs an addressing of...
But as it were, you've gone to the most literally fundamental issue that a government can involve itself in.
Absolutely.
Which is keeping the streets clean. I mean, it's something that occurs in Bombay as well, right at the heart of it.
I mean, but Bombay, what is so interesting about the history of Bombay in the 19th century is exactly the same conversations that were happening in Birmingham, in Glasgow, in Liverpool in the 1830s and 40s are then happening in Bombay in the 1870s and 80s. But you also see, on the one hand, the sort of beneficent power of state state intervention and structural reform, improving life expectancy, improving water supply, all these things. But you also see, in terms of the Bombay presidency during the famines there, again, the use of the state, the use of railway, actually to accelerate and exacerbate famine, because, again, the hoarding of food, getting it into the urban white districts and away from the rural areas. So, as my colleagues were, the history of the British state in India and British India is a very mixed one.
Anjan Sundaram, sorry, you just wanted to come in there.
Yes, I wanted to come in. For example, security is an area where it's absolutely essential for the government to play a role. I described in my book, meeting a warlord who was going to attack a city. And he had a terrible reputation. He probably responsible for mass murders. But when I went and met him, I discovered that he'd once been a nurse for the Red Cross. And so you realize that, and he'd witnessed his family being massacred and decided that the government wasn't providing security, so he had to take matters into his own hands, form his own militia. And all across Congo, because the government does not provide security, basic security, you have villagers arming the young boys and creating militias that begin with noble intentions. But then when you don't have justice, you don't have accountability, all hell breaks loose.
But you also see, classically in terms of the Congo, that history of what, Karl Marx called, primitive accumulation, the history of colonial extraction, which is then at the basis of the economies of so much of these cities, then over and over again. What I thought was fascinating about your book about that language of so much riches in the soil that it was all dumped there afterwards, and then you have this wave and wave of extractors coming in, beginning with the Belgians, and picking up the pieces of that.
I was struck having read your book, Adrian Wooldridge, that it is almost a perfect example of the Hobbesian world, isn't it?
Exactly.
Wherein men live without other security than what their own strength and their own inventions shall furnish.
It does show that the fundamental role of the state is to provide security and to get rid of warlords and get rid of petty disputes which destroy civil society and to provide order. But I just wanted to come back on this point about mass poverty in India, which is obviously a huge problem. And if you compare democratic India with authoritarian China, where would you rather be poor? And I think it's the case that over the last 20 years, China has done more to solve fundamental problems of access to food, water, sanitation, to create infrastructure for the future than India has. So it's a challenge to democracy to see the rate and nature of progress in China.
Cherry Latta-Hogg?
Absolutely, because in China, you've had a capitalist state which has allowed or created a situation where there is access to healthcare, there is a basic provision of education, and the Indian state has failed in that. But however, India is a democracy. We've recently seen how the Congress party has been swept out and a new government is in place for precisely these reasons, because the government was not perceived to deliver and did not deliver.
And the first thing that Modi did when he was elected was to point to China and say, this is the example we look to, this is the example we want to model. This is what
he would say that because it is exactly the kind of crony capitalism that is pervasive in China is what he wants to replicate in India. Modi is a product of the capitalists who put him in position.
I thought it was interesting. He had very little interest in coming west. Actually, the level of disjuncture between modern India and, quite rightly, its 20th century and 19th century past. Actually, this just wasn't even on the table in the conversation.
Yes.
It was about India as a global power and what it can and can't learn from competing
sources. Have we potentially
sources.
Got this the wrong way around, though, that we're thinking the deficit in democracy is not one of efficiency, it's one of moral value. There's a wonderful quote from Florence Nightingale in your book about Bombay. She agitated massively for cleaning up Bombay and creating sewers. And she says, in holding India, we must be able to show the moral right of our tenure.
Yes,
and that was the at the heart of it. And that surely is at the heart of any functioning democratic government, that you must think it's right to do it that way.
And that was what you can see, in a sense, each of the cities I look at, them expressing their, it's that comrade idea about the idea. An idea has to be behind it. What you're doing has to be validated by an idea, whether it's in the Congo or whether it's actually providing sanitation and water in Bombay. In New Delhi, of course, the idea becomes just in and of itself. Actually what they're doing almost becomes second best to the display of architecture and power.
Adam syndrome.
Yes, I'd like to come back to Adrian's point about China. The Rwandan government makes similar claims about progress and its efficiency. I found in my experience that the Rwandans themselves are incapable of testing those claims. If were they to conduct research or to release reports that contradicted that government narrative, they would be shut down. And I wonder whether there is certainly progress in both Rwanda and China. I wonder if we have a true picture at what cost this comes. And I'm not convinced, based on my experience in Rwanda. I saw things that were not reported, tens of thousands of people homeless that no one had reported on, and is never factored in to narratives of Rwanda's success. And I'm sure the case is
I think that's absolutely true in China. And in the book, The Fourth Revolution, we do talk at great length and in great detail about the failures of the system, the accumulation of money in the hands of the princelings, the extraordinary system whereby you can't move around the country without certificates.
You also point at one point to a poll stating that 85% of Chinese citizens are satisfied with their government. I thought that was a bit disingenuous from a journalist for The Economist.
Let me come back on that, because I think that the polling data is not perfect in an authoritarian society. Of course it's not. But that data, particular piece of data there, it came from the Pew Research, which is a Washington, D.C.-based research organization, I think very, very highly regarded. And what they were looking at there was the level of satisfaction of people expressed right across the world, and China comes out very high. And I think if you've had a situation in which your background was the Cultural Revolution, oppression, Mao Zedong, and you've had your living standards dramatically revolutionized over the last 10 years, 20 years, you can understand why people might think things are going in a better direction than they were.
Cherry Latta-Hogg, I want to turn to you because you've spent a lot of time recently working on a place where democracy is in trouble, Thailand. And democracy seems to be a central element of the problem rather than a solution at the moment. Is that a fair assessment?
I think Thailand, the problem has to be traced back to an age-old struggle between the elite and the rural classes. So essentially, what we saw right now in terms of a very undemocratic response to the government, the caretaker government that was in power, was because the monarchy and the military and the business elite in Bangkok have controlled the reins of power for far too long. It is a struggle between democracy and an elite-led monarchy. So, yes, indeed, democracy is under threat. But the question really is, did democracy ever take root in Thailand? And the fact that you have provisions like martial law, which can be exercised, and let's not forget that this is not new. Martial law has been in place since 2004 in the southern provinces. 6,000 people have died in the past 10 years in the south. It's one of Asia's very little-known conflicts. And the state response to this conflict has not succeeded. How can we hope for it to succeed in Bangkok? The real issue over here is, will the Thai government actually realize that political democracy means voicing and vocalizing the aspirations of people all across the country and not just a section of elite? We don't see that taking firm roots yet.
And do you need, the other critical element that you need is an independent judiciary. I mean, that is absolutely central to any functioning government, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And the same, you have another example in Sri Lanka where you're sceptical about the degree to which the judiciary is independent.
Absolutely. And I think this brings us very neatly into the post-conflict states in South Asia, Sri Lanka and Nepal, where, you know, a certain conflict came to an end in Nepal with the Maoists, a decade-long conflict. In Sri Lanka, a three-decade conflict with the Sri Lankan Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. And the promise was that a new society, a new just society would evolve. But in place, what we have seen is a flashback to authoritarianism and the rights of minorities being suppressed, the judicial institutions of democracy, judiciary, free media, rights to association, assembly, expression, the foundation principles which are entrenched in the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which most countries are signatories to, are not realized in these states. And to me, that brings us very neatly to what the role of the state is. The role of the state is to be just, provide equitable distribution of wealth, provide sustainable growth, provide a sense of security and rights connect to life to its citizens.
I think you would have agreed to sort of up until the point she got provides sustainable growth.
Sustainable distribution. I think she said just distribution of wealth. No, I wouldn't think that the role of the state is to micromanage the distribution of wealth, although inheritance taxes are certainly a valuable tool of meritocracy in the long term. But I do think that she's absolutely right, that the important thing about democracy is just not one man or one woman, one vote, but a constitutional regime which limits the power of governments and provides rules whereby governments should operate. And one of the things that's happened with democracy since 2000 is not only that the spread of democracy around the world has sort of come to a halt, but we're getting the rise of a sort of pseudo-democracy, which is authoritarian regimes which claim the legitimacy of the vote, but do not constrain the power of government, Russia being one of the most dramatic examples.
Well, and you have experience, Anjan Sundaram, in your book of in the Congo, of an election. I mean, a wonderfully touching moment, huge turnout. This in a country in which no road has been built for 50 years and where it's almost impossible to get to the polling station, 80-something percent turnout. So clearly a massive appetite. Mm-hmm. For this thing that's missing, yes. But of course it's a Potemkin village when it turns up.
Yes, an incredible challenge to get even ballot boxes out to polling stations and by canoe and by motorcycle. That effort was matched by immense expectation. I remember there's a scene where I'm at a hotel and I'm complaining because the electricity has gone out and the generator is not working. And the boy at the hotel says to me, "Don't worry, sir. We're going to have elections and we're going to be like France and America. We'll have electricity." And, of course, that did not come to pass.
Not California. Well, the first thing that happens is that a gunfight breaks out in Kinshasa.
Exactly.
Immediately after the election.
Immediately. And I was stuck in a little factory while the president-elect and his challenger were fighting it out in the streets because they could not come to agree with the process that they had signed up to in the first place. And they knew that there would be very little repercussion to them taking up arms.
I wanted to perhaps get you to answer Adrian Wooldridge's dilemma, which is if you're living in the Congo, would you prefer, as it were, the strong man who delivers essential services and makes the electricity run and cleans the streets, or do you think there's still a hunger for democracy? A kind of idealistic desire for democracy.
I think the Congolese have a very clear idea of what life and what their country ought to look like. And while I wouldn't want to wish for myself or for anyone else life in a war zone in the east of Congo where life is absolutely terrible, I do believe that in the rest of Congo, which is largely at peace, despite the lack of government, Rousseau would have been rather pleased at man's goodness. I do believe that over there is a certain idea of what their lives could be and a certain vision and hope. And I would personally choose to live in those places rather than in a place where someone in my family could disappear, where I live in constant fear of state services, of state authorities, and where I know that there is very little opportunity or avenue for any kind of accountability should the state not open itself up to that sort of discussion.
I mean, you have an experience. You're mugged in Kinshasa, and what follows is a kind of black comedy of what happens when the state doesn't exist. You have to walk for 2 hours to get to a policeman. When you get to them, he charges you for filling out the report and then offers to bring in something called Team Cobra, which will work for you for business expenses only. But that's it. There isn't anything else. Nobody else is going to help.
No, you even have to pay to fill up report your theft, and I didn't have any money.
Because it had all been stolen off you.
Exactly. And there was this touching moment when I realized that ours was the only house in which we did not have electricity on our street, and I wondered why, and I went out in the street. Everyone else had electricity, and the father or the my family had decided that they would not pay the bribe to the local electricity company to wire themselves to the grid illegally. And I really, there was a sense of futility. I thought, what is this man trying to do? Is he trying to take on this corrupt behemoth all on his own?
And now, on the other side, you also write about the Donut Society, which is, mm-hmm. what it seems to me is almost a proto-welfare state that exists in these small bidonville and the slums, where you have a small area of that township and everybody looks after everybody else.
Yes.
That you basically surrender what you've got when anybody asks for it, but it's reciprocal and you've got to do that back again. It's a problem because nobody ever accumulates any kind of capital to build anything more substantial, isn't it?
Yes. The moment you have $10, you have 9 people lining up at your door, a dollar each, and everyone has a dollar. So no one is able to surmount their impoverished state, accumulate capital, invest it. And this is a classic example of where the state should be providing services like financial services, social security, that would allow people to be included in the financial system, where people themselves have to improvise a solution and arrive at something that is morally comprehensible, but just inefficient.
There's a free market argument for a slightly bigger state.
I would say you can see versions of this in Brazil in the favelas, whereby you get slum communities generating some sort of social order, some sort of sense of mutual obligation, mutual support. So you're getting a sort of quasi-state support mechanism being generated by mutual assistance. On the other hand, if you look at the actual state, the Brazilian state, you see something that's profoundly alien. You see the pacification police who come in and pacify these poor people in these slums with extraordinary violence. You also see the state basically devoting huge amounts of resources to the rich. You know, the university education, which is free, goes almost entirely to the wealthy. Civil servants there retiring in their 50s. An extraordinarily dysfunctional state, really providing services for the rich, not for the poor. So I think the poor looking after themselves is a solution to that problem.
Charulata Hogg, do you see examples of this in Sri Lanka and in Thailand, of as it were, people filling the vacuum of a government with their own arrangements?
I would say in Sri Lanka, this doesn't exist. It doesn't happen. The state is so authoritarian and the control is
there
so
is no
absolute
vacuum.
That there is no vacuum. And in fact, what we found, and you know, again, you know, figures are such a misnomer to actual the situation on the ground. Sri Lanka has shown a high growth rate, 8% growth rate in the last years, since the end of the conflict in particular. But this is concentrated purely in the south. The north...
It seems to me, though, also what is filling the vacuum is China. And in both of your works, I mean, when we think about rising and falling empires, even though, as it were, the ideology of modern China is in theory relentlessly anti-imperialist and anti-colonial, when you see and you talk about the String of Pearls naval bases, when you look at the military infrastructure and then the trading infrastructure,
absolutely.
Burma, Thailand and Sri Lanka, it is clearly the sort of... The staging posts of some notion of empire.
Anjan Sundaram, you write about this as well, don't you?
Yes, exactly. I just want to add a line to this discussion to say that we agree, I think we all agree that entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial people are essential to the rise of a society and economy, but you do need some government to allow people to be entrepreneurial for that to amount to something.
Yeah. Just one quick point on the role of state and particularly China. I think the role of a state is not limited within its boundaries. It exercises a role outside its boundaries. As we've seen at the Security Council recently, China and Russia's veto have prevented the referral of Syria to the ICC. This is hugely damaging. It will encourage violations against people. Similarly, we've had China adopt a very ambivalent position on, say, human rights abuses in Burma, in Sri Lanka. So, you know, again, I think when we look at these rising Asian states and the control they exercise.
But it's even more dramatic than that, I think, with state capitalism, in that what you have with China is these state companies, essentially, which are arms of the state, albeit in a rather complicated way, and they are building roads, building bridges, building infrastructure right across.
But they're also building here. We have this extraordinary situation where Chinese money is going to rebuild the Crystal Palace in London, in theory, rebuild the King George VI dock, these great symbols of British imperial prowess. And then in my book, I look at what it's doing in Liverpool via the Peel Group and the plans for a Shanghai Tower. So this history of imperial cities begins to sort of go full circle.
What's fascinating about this, though, is though they would never say it, the Chinese are doing it in the name of free trade. The great driver of cities like Hong Kong, the original foundation of Hong Kong, built on the notion that free trade was going to be the thing that was going to transform the world.
And that always, you know, provides the language about internationalism and Pacific ideas and win-win, and there's no agenda behind this. And actually, that was exactly the language of the British and Hong Kong. This was just to be a free trade port and everyone would benefit.
And what did it lead to?
It led to a number of wars.
A number of wars in which we forced the Chinese to take our drugs.
Exactly. I don't think we should say that the modern Chinese state is going that way, but I do think it's interesting to see the influx of that money in traditional urban form.
But I think it's Adrian very important not to underestimate the challenge that's coming from China, both in terms of the intervention and the establishment of Chinese power and economic influence, particularly right across Africa, where that's connected with political influence in a way that's probably not in Liverpool, but also the ideological challenge that there's a sense that democracies can't get things done, that the quality of democracy both in the United States and in the European Union is going down. The Chinese can get things done and they don't have to deal with all these
nuances. I will be holding the government to account here this afternoon. The government, we're going to get it really well done
very quickly, Anjan Sandrum, because we're running out of time.
Yes, in China, and I write this in Africa, I write about this in my book, the Chinese government is so powerful that it's come to supplant or fill that vacuum left by the non-existent African states. And the people are confused. They are shocked by these immense roads run across the country, immense ideas, huge towers, when they're used to a system in which their ideas never amount to much.
Okay, well, I don't think we're going to solve the problem today, but thank you all for the discussion of it. Cherry Latterhock from Chatham House, Adrian Woolridge's The Fourth Revolution, and Tristram Hunt's 10 Cities That Made an Empire, and Anjan Sundaram's Stories from the Congo Stringer are all out now. Next week, Pain, Suffering and Infectious Diseases with Joanna Burke, Norman Fowler and Jeremy Farrar. Doesn't sound very appetising, I promise you. It's only the ideas that are contagious. For now, thank you and goodbye.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.